And now we let Maureen in. sorry. Someone else in a minute. Okay. An announcement to start with. Hello. Everyone here, is that good? We're not having a Bible school next week, having a week off. It is actually half term, not that that makes too much of a difference, but having a break. So our next one is in a fortnight, which actually is in November. Believe it or not, we'll be clocks will have changed and we'll be into November. And then we'll probably do a run of about four during November. So I'll say it again, and you'll come out on Steve's usual newsletter things that no Bible school next week, back again on the 3rd of November. I've got three little snippets to start with. I haven't had any snippets for a while. Have a look at Psalm 84 and verse 10. Psalm 84 and verse 10. The well-known verse, and if someone told me something the other day which upsets your usual way of understanding it, but actually makes it make more sense, to be honest. Psalm should be easy, here we are. So Psalm 84, verse 10, it's the one that begins, better is one day in your courts. Let's let someone else in. So I'd be interested to know what your translation has in a moment, but Psalm 84 verse 10 is the one where the second bit, as I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of the wicked. Anyone got any significantly different translation for the second half of Psalm 84 verse 10?
Well, live the good life in the homes of the wicked.
So instead of dwell, you've got?
Live the good life.
Live the good life. Oh, okay. Quotes, good life, as in, you know, what we can do. Okay. Anybody else?
Dwell at ease in the tents of the wicked.
That's interesting. Okay. So you're all focusing on that bit. Anyone got anything different to, I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God?
But I would rather stand at the threshold of the house of my God.
Yes. Which version is that?
That's the New American Standard.
Okay. Now, when you see the word doorkeeper, you think of, someone who's keeping the door, the gatekeeper, that sort of person. I've done a lot on doorkeepers, gatekeepers, and so on. But actually, as you just said, the translation really is just someone who lingers at the threshold. Sorry, we've got someone talking mute. No, it is.
Inquiry into child sexual abuse to make it a criminal offence for anyone working with children failed or concerns about abuse.
Sorry, who's got a...
Okay.
It was Joy. She's Joy muted better. Her.
So. Okay, well, I just muted it, so thank you. I thought it might be. Right. So someone said, did you realise the Hebrew, there isn't a doorkeeper, it's just someone who is at the threshold, almost like lingering at the threshold. In other words, it's about where they are rather than what they're doing. They don't actually have to be a doorkeeper, which, of course, is a very important position. And actually, that word for lingering at the threshold could mean on the outside or the inside. Mm-hmm. Now, you might think that surely the sentiment of it is that I'd rather be just inside the door of the house of my God rather than, as you rightly said, having this great life elsewhere in the tents of the wicked. So it's not actually saying I would rather have this official position. It's just better than having a life with the wicked is even just to be on the edge, the very edge of the house of God. And if you think about the first part of the verse, again, the same sentiment, but in different words, better is one day in your courts than 1,000 elsewhere. One day where, well, in the courts, in the courtyard of the temple area, not even inside the actual temple itself. In other words, you haven't actually gone into the into the temple like the priest would. It's just in the outer parts of it. So the best understanding of the second half is to match the first half, which is, as we just said, I'd rather be hanging around somewhere around the door or the entrance of the house of God than having this nice, secure, easy life amongst the wicked. So I thought that was interesting, and calling it a doorkeeper is one of those translations where somehow it's got sort of fixed into our mentality, but that isn't quite the best. If you've got a comment, just leap in on that. Otherwise, I'm moving to the next snippet. But it's interesting that one version, just one version, New American Standard Version, actually has that translated differently then. Everybody else has got a doorkeeper, presumably. And so that's what it's meant to be. So I'm sorry, that's ruined another little song again, hasn't it? Because we sing about I'd rather be a doorkeeper. I think that's one of the choruses and so on. Right, 1 Kings 12 next. My attention was drawn to this. I should have asked you a little teasing question first, really. Where do we read about the golden calves? Where do we read about the golden calves? And the point of that teasing question is that I've said calves, plural, not the golden calf. Because we all know where that comes. But I'd certainly forgotten until I looked at this again. That's the second part of, no, it's actually towards the end, really. Towards the end of 1 Kings 12, we've got Jeroboam, who has, of course, rebelled against Rehoboam. And he's trying to set up an alternative system. He actually, at this point, which is verse 28, says the king made 2 golden calves after seeking advice. What kind of advice that was. But basically, he's saying we don't want people to go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem. Otherwise, that would give allegiance back to Rehoboam. So what am I going to do? I'm going to set up these alternatives, these 2 golden calves, and say to the people, oh, you don't need to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel. And one was set up at Bethel, and the other in Dan, in the north. And as we know, this became a great, great sin. But then it was what I read later on that I thought was even more powerful, really. Having decided to set up this alternative religious system and put 2 calves in 2 different places in the country, it says from verse 31, I think that is, he built shrines on high places and appointed priests from all sorts of people, even though they were not Levites. So he is starting to develop an alternative non-Levitical priesthood. Okay, putting people in a position that they weren't entitled to. And then it goes on, he instituted a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the one held in Judah. But it says, if you jump down to verse 33, on the 15th day of the 8th month, a month of his own choosing, he offered sacrifices on the altar. And that phrase, a month of his own choosing, creating a new festival on the 15th day of that month, really brought me up short. Any thoughts as to why, or does it impact you in any particular way? A new festival on a new date in a month of his own choosing.
In the New King James, it says devised in his own heart.
Okay.
Which is kind of even, it wasn't like a whim.
Right.
Which, you know, it obviously given some serious heart thought, if that's how to put it.
Yeah.
Go on, Mary. Is it anything to do with the 8th month? Because the 8th is new beginnings, it's a new thing.
Well, It may be, but the point is there isn't any festival in the eighth month, is there?
No, but he's made one.
Well, that's right. So he obviously chooses a month that's not used. But what do we know about all the other festivals? What are feasts? What are they actually called? Gods. What's the phrase that we use?
Appointed times.
Appointed times. God's appointed times. You're not allowed to change them.
He's changed it from God's appointed times to his dividing to do that.
That to me was the impact of this. Oh, of his own choosing. No, that isn't a light matter. That isn't something that, okay, it doesn't matter. He's just done this. He's actually going against what God has appointed and therefore particularly chosen. Oh, let's do the next month after the seventh month has got them all. And I'm afraid my mind went thinking about this a bit further. Aren't the Christian feasts put into places of our own or the church's own choosing? For instance, the 12th month, our 12th month. And haven't we got priests in charge of, what we call them, churches, religious institutions and so on, who really are not God's appointed people? And maybe think, okay, we've started to, or perhaps for a long time we've been actually going down the same sort of path, the same rebellion against God's ways, God's times, and God's appointed people and times, just as this desire to create something of our own choosing, and let's hope that God joins in, if you like. And it's rebellion in this case, not put too fine a point on it. He was rebelling. So sometimes when you read a passage, particularly one that you haven't looked at for a while, or someone else has brought it to your attention, and suddenly a phrase stands out about that, that just makes it suddenly a bit more powerful. I think I had a hand somewhere. Was it John? Where's he gone?
Well, but I didn't want to interrupt your flow.
No, it's all right. As long as your hand stays up, I know.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Council of Nicaea, which is more than a little bit ago, where they also decided to change all those times.
Yeah.
And did it deliberately against these people, and therefore against God's appointed times.
Yeah.
So so it continues today. And I have been recently reading a book by a Catholic guy. Oh, I'm trying to remember the name.
The Anguish of the Jews?
The Anguish of the Jews, which was written in the 60s, early 60s. And whilst he has many points there about anti-Semitism, basically, when it comes to the Council of Nicaea, it's not, it's mentioned, but it's not mentioned as an area of difficulty. And as such, it's one of the main things that kind of derailed the process of believers, if you like, or potential believers, discipleship.
Yeah.
It seemed, I hadn't thought of it quite like that before, but it certainly made me think, whoa, he might have picked up on some other things because of the Holocaust and the Catholic process with some individuals in that. So serious stuff.
Yeah, and I think somewhere, and it might be in Daniel, one of those prophetic bits, it talks about the Antichrist or the man of lawlessness, or however he's going to be mentioned, described there, that he changed the set times. That little phrase comes in, you remember that? I can't remember which of the final chapters of Daniel it is, but when it's going through all the things that this man does that comes along, the sort of equivalent of the Antichrist, it says that he changed the set times, which I assume means tells the Jews they can't have their feast at those times. And the other little snippet is actually to do with a feast, which is not a biblical one, but we know, well, not a, a calendar feast, but we know that Jesus went to, and that was Hanukkah, the winter feast, the one that's there in what is about our December time. And the word Hanukkah, now I think you probably know what Hanukkah is all about. So do you know what the word Hanukkah means then? Because that describes what the festival is.
Dedication.
Feast of dedication. And the word dedication is coming from that. So the root, of course, is Hanukkah. Yeah, Hanukkah. Hanukkah. And literally, the root means that the three letters give you the meaning of to make narrow, to narrow something. And that's what dedication is all about. There was one person in the Old Testament, well-known character, whose name is also based upon Hanukkah, although the H doesn't sound, instead it's the vowel sound, the H has dropped off, so he's really just a Nukkah, but with an U in front of it. I'm waiting for someone to put me out of misery here.
Is it Nukkah?
Say again?
Noah. No,
because there's an at the front.
Nebuchadnezzar.
Anakin.
No, you're going too far. It's Enoch.
Oh,
Enoch.
Mm. Yeah.
So his root is also a hurt, which doesn't sound, I think. Anyway, it's a nut and a cur. And therefore, his name also means dedicated. And of course, he was the man who walked with God. That was his dedication. And he walked on a particular path, because that's what walking means in Jewish terms, following a path. And it's the same idea as Jesus when he says, you've got to find the narrow route or the road that leads to life is the narrow one. And it's the same word as well, which is actually used in Proverbs 22 and verse 6. A very well-known verse where you probably have it translated as train up a child or teach him or instruct him in the way that he should go. That's Proverbs 22, verse 6. And it's literally chanok a child in the way he should go, which is basically narrow his way down, okay? Make him dedicated by only giving him, allowing him the narrow way to go. Of course, he may refuse it and go off astray at the end. But the idea of training, bringing up, instructing the child is at least showing him the narrow way. So all that's tied in with the idea of a Hanukkah. And of course, the Hanukkah dedication of the temple was, of course, after the cleansing of the temple, after the time of the Greeks when they got their independence back again. Almost a rededication to the Lord, wasn't it? Oh, and one other use of the Hanukkah word in Hebrew, modern Hebrew, housewarming party is called a Hanukkat Beit. Hanukkat Beit, house at the end there. Literally the dedication of the house. That's what their housewarming party is called. So that's a little verbal snippet, which I thought was quite fun, particularly when you find these other references that all tie into it. Right, so a couple of things from James. Oh, thank you. The Anguish of the Jews by Edward Flannery. Not heard of that at all. Okay, so it's in the chat if you want to follow that up. Oh, you're holding it up as well. So you can just turn it again because I didn't see the... Okay. Oh, it's just simple as big title on it. Okay, so it's not a brand new book. I think you said it'd been out for quite a while, 60s or something. Yeah. So a couple of bits from James and then maybe one other thing, if time allows. So for those who already found James, you're ahead of us there. We're going to look at part of chapter 1. And I'm going to read from verse 19 to the end. But I'm going to read it in a very much expanded form. So this isn't a translation as such, it's an expansion of it to try and bring out more of the meaning. So while you're following it in your version, that's James 1 verses 19 to 27, you're going to hear me read something that will take about three times as long, because the idea is to bring out the meaning of all the different words and phrases. And then we'll just discuss what you think comes out of that passage, not necessarily of the text I'm going to read, but just generally what's in that. But it might spark off the fact that I'm reading it out in this other form. So here we go, from James chapter 1, verse 19. My dear brothers, make sure that what you already know and are familiar with becomes more firmly embedded and certain within you. Every one of us should be eager to listen carefully and not rush into speaking too soon. Nor should we be quick to take offence or stir up anger within us. Rather, our anger should be controlled, for bursts of outrage do not produce the righteous activity which God desires to see in us. Also, to this end, distance yourselves completely from all that is morally repugnant and foul, just as you would throw away clothes so soiled and filthy that they cannot be made clean again. Your behaviour and conduct is not to be corrupted. You must avoid contact with the overflowing abundance of evil that is all around. Instead, with a humble spirit, pay more and more attention to the message of salvation that became rooted within you when you were born again, and which has the power to change the inner man and remove all that displeases God. But this will not happen if you simply listen to the words. This is betraying yourself, cheating yourself of its full power and benefits. For these, you must become a doer of what it is saying. Whenever you spend time in front of a mirror, you always consider carefully what you see there and act accordingly. It's no good at all if the moment you walk away, you can't remember your own face. Likewise, look closely at what you see in God's law. Stand in front of it, fully focused and absorbed, for this law is so good it cannot be bettered. It is designed to bring you freedom. But again, for this to happen, you must not let it go in one ear and out the other. Act upon it, then you will receive God's blessing upon your whole life. If you wish to be a pious and dutiful observer of the faith, then you must think carefully about the words you use and the way you say them. Otherwise, you will fall prey to deception and delude your own heart. There will also be a barrenness and futility about your worship and service for God, just as in pagan religions. The outward signs of religious devotion, which God, who is our Father, looks upon as acceptable and blameless, have two features. One involves looking after those in need, such as orphans and widows, giving them regular help and relief from the stresses and pressures of their circumstances. The other is to constantly protect yourself from becoming contaminated by the godless society which makes up our world. So that's my expanded version of those few verses, based upon the exact Greek words and trying to pull out as much meaning from them as possible in each little phrase, each little sentence or so. Malcolm, what have you got to say? Yep. Are you saying something? Because Malcolm, we can't hear you. No, we can't hear you.
Have you switched your microphone off? Not on the side there.
Mm. We heard him before.
We heard.
Obviously,
you.
Taking the advice very, very powerfully, not to speak too quickly or open your mouth too soon or say too many words. So. Thank you for that visual illustration. I hope you can come back to us eventually anyway.
Yeah.
In the meantime, anybody else?
I thought it was very good. It really brought out so much more. I was just brief comment.
Yeah, okay, thanks. It took a long time to do because I looked at every Greek word and checked in all the usual sort of dictionaries and things as to where it had been used and what it could mean. And this really was a case of using six words instead of one. But if you start to bring out different aspects of it, then hopefully it does bring out the meaning and therefore what to do about it. John?
It left no wiggle room.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay.
It was very clear what you should and shouldn't be doing. So, well done. When are you going to do the whole book?
I don't know. I have done the whole of the letter to the Romans, and that took several hours. Well, days, I suppose, really. I tried it with Romans, but I only did it for that passage because I was speaking on it at some point in the past. So I thought, this is really for me to try and make sure I'm saying exactly the right thing and that. But one of the things that crops up in there, it's the famous bit about it's no good spending time in front of a mirror if the moment you walk away, you can't remember your own face. And one of the things I was thinking about is what did they understand in those days by a mirror? What do you think James's readers would actually get when he talks about just that word, the mirror, because we know what it means today? Any thoughts about mirrors? John again, or Rose?
I wonder if they were looking in water.
Well,
I know they use burnished bronze too, but that was pretty hard to come by. Water is really the only reflective thing.
Yes, that is a good point. They didn't have the sort of glass mirrors that we have today, although the Romans started to use them sometime around this time, I think. But you're right, in both cases, probably the water, because you can see your face in that. But they did have, archaeologists found mirrors made of burnished bronze. And there are references in scripture elsewhere to mirrors in the Old Testament. Anyone remember anything about them?
Is that something to do with the lever?
Yeah, go on. Do you know?
I'm not sure. I just know the lever's made out.
didn't the women give their mirrors?
Have a look at Exodus 38, verse 8, because that's the reference I've got. I don't think it actually mentions the word mirror, but Exodus 38, verse 8.
Yeah.
If you're ahead of me, do you want to read it out if you've already found it?
Bezalel made the basin and its base of bronze from the mirrors of the attending women who served and ministered at the temple.
Yeah, okay.
At the doorway of the meeting, sorry.
Yeah, from the mirrors of the women. Notice it's the women that had mirrors, as though they needed them more. There is another reference to a mirror in Job 37, verse 18. Job going to end up somewhere near the Psalms. Yeah. Job 37, verse 18, it talks about a mirror of cast bronze. I'm not quite sure what the context is, but it's just interesting. Oh, there are, yes. Job 37, 18. Can you join him in spreading out the skies? Hard as a mirror of cast bronze. So they did have, I suppose, what you might think of as a rather poor early version of this. And it's perhaps therefore what Paul is referring to in 1 Corinthians 13, we now see as through a glass darkly, or basically we only see a poor reflection, because I guess in none of these cases they worked as well as what eventually we have and what the Romans developed using glass. And so on. So it's not a common image, but it certainly means something within the context of that passage. Because usually when you look in the mirror, and this includes men, not just women, but you look in the mirror in order to work out what you need to go away and do, or what you need to do even before you go away, you know, what you need to do. Do you need a shave, that sort of thing? And you need to get your makeup right more. I don't know, but anyway. So spending time in front of a mirror is usually done with a purpose in mind in order to improve yourself, shall we say, in some form or other. So it's a lovely, typical little illustration that he uses from pretty well everyday life. anything else from that passage that that struck you or does now as you look through it again? Remember, he picks up lots of little themes and then actually develops them sometimes somewhere else. Maureen?
I've got here in Exodus 30, Exodus 30, verse 18, make a bronze basin with a bronze base, place it between the tent and the altar, and put water in it.
Yeah. That's what they use these mirrors for. So in fact, there's a double reflection there because you had the water as well to look into and see your own face. Thank you. What about the bit about God's special heart for the fatherless and the widows? Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this. Does that surprise you, or is that one of those things where you say, oh yeah, I've read about that before? But you still got your hand up, Maureen, or are you coming back on something else? It's your old hand, isn't it? Fatherless and widows, what do we remember about that? Even if you can't quote an exact verse, but you think James is saying something new here, or does it remind you of other things?
I think that's in the commandments, is it not?
Yeah.
The children of Israel had to remember that they were slaves in a foreign country, and they had to look out for people that were in need, and also the widows and the orphans.
Yeah. There's a couple of passages we could look at. Deuteronomy 27:19. Deuteronomy 27:19, that puts it fairly strongly. Someone like to read that verse if you've got it. Deuteronomy 27:19.
Cursed is he who distorts or perverts the just, or it's amplified version. Hang on a minute.
Yeah, that's fine.
Cursed is anyone who withholds justice from the foreigner, the fatherless, or the widow, and all the people shall say amen.
Yeah. So a curse upon the man who doesn't give them justice. Exodus 22 and verses 22 and 23. Exodus 22, verses 22 and 23. Anyone got that? Am I giving you the right numbers? I'm always nervous if nobody comes up with it.
So,
I got the right number.
Take advantage of a widow or an orphan. Yeah. If you do and they cry out to me, I will certainly hear their cry. My anger will be aroused and I will kill you with the sword. Your wives will become widows and your children fatherless.
Yeah, thank you. Actually, that extra verse is important as well, isn't it? Don't take advantage of a widow or an orphan. Otherwise, they'll cry out, I will hear it. And then your wives and your children will become like them because I'll kill you. That's putting it very strongly, really. In Psalm 68, God says he is a father to the fatherless and a defender of widows. And what about Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 17?
Yeah, I just was going to say that one to you.
Yeah.
It's, well, learn to do good, seek justice, reprove the ruthless, defend the orphan, plead for the widow.
Yeah. Defend the cause of the fatherless, plead the case of the widow. Now, obviously, these in their society, were very, very vulnerable, wasn't it? I mean, the widow and therefore the orphan children, no other support. So they became very vulnerable if people decided to either take advantage of them or not look after them. I think there's another one in Jeremiah 22, verse 3. Jeremiah 22, verse 3.
Just going back, just before that, going back to Isaiah again in verse Isaiah 1:23, it goes on again. It says, they do not defend the orphan, nor does the widow's plea come before them.
Right. Yeah. So we've got Jeremiah as well, Jeremiah 22, verse 3. Yeah, it's pretty similar, isn't it? The bit there is, do no wrong or violence to the alien, the fatherless, or the widow. So the alien is often lumped in with that as well.
Somewhere, is it in the woes against the Pharisees? I can't quite remember. Does Jesus not accuse the Pharisees of taking away the homes of the widows?
The homes, did you say?
Yeah, of the widow. Is it not of the widows?
It's not ringing any immediate bells, but... So you're looking in Matthew 23, are you?
I'm not sure.
Well, that's the woes.
Right, Matthew's...
Of which there's a lot.
It may not be there. Somewhere there's something ringing a bell there.
I'm just glancing through it. Nothing's leaping out at me. There's all the other things they do that's wrong.
I've got to find that now.
Yeah, I'll leave you to sort that out. Because I don't think it's. I don't think it's in the Matthew 23 woes.
May not be. No.
Yeah. But it sounds the sort of thing that could be. God has a special heart, and sometimes, you know, we think God treats everyone the same. God has no favourites. God loves everyone the same. But actually, at times, he does have a special love or a special heart or a special favour, particularly for the poor, the vulnerable, and so on. And it's the sort of thing that I suppose in our society we sort of agree with it, but we perhaps sort of let other people deal with those sort of problems. Perhaps we should keep a special eye open, particularly in our own Christian communities, for those that need that sort of support.
Isn't that sort of thing like Feed the Hungry and all the, you know, food banks?
Well,
that's not what we're sort of doing. And the other thing I was always taught, when you're harvesting your food, and it's a bit silly here because we're behind a locked gate, but you're not supposed to go backwards over it. So
yeah.
Although, you know, if you're picking blackberries, there's always more when you go back because you see the ones behind the leaves, don't you?
Yeah.
I'm biblical and I always kind of, it always feels wrong to go back and strip the whole bush bare.
Well, the question is, would anybody else come along and help themselves to it anyway?
So in my own.
It's probably better for you to collect them all and then leave a little basket outside the gate or something and say,
and give them away.
Help yourself, like you do find there. People put my allotments produce too much and they just leave it out there and you hope that the right people take them. But we've got in Chesham, sorry, John, I'll come to you in a minute. We in Chesham have got what's called a community fridge.
Yes.
Okay, I'll just finish. There's a fridge because some of the food is frozen. But we encourage the supermarkets that would normally just chuck the food away, and they bring in loads and loads and loads of it. This is different from a food bank, but it's organised by the churches. And I think twice a week, Wednesday morning, Saturday morning, you see huge queues of people coming just to collect a basket full of stuff that the supermarkets have handed over that is technically sort of beyond what they can sell. And it might be loaves of bread, and it might be fruit that would go off very quickly. But there's also a fridge because some of the stuff needs to be kept in a fridge. And that was an initiative of the churches in Chesham. So are you familiar with that idea then, Alison?
Well, Lechet, Lechet something, it's a whole system in Israel.
Okay.
Right across the country. Yeah, they have to have fridges because it's hot. And so if a farmer is digging up, say they're getting rid of all their tomatoes to start something else, they'll contact them and they say, right, it's available till tomorrow or something. And then Lechet Israel. So then the people will go with their vans and pick it all up and take it and distribute it. So everybody knows about it. It's a bit like social services, but they don't have it formally. Yeah. But it is an organisation.
There's never been a shortage of the food being donated by whatever, whichever supermarket is. And they probably come from outside of Chesham as well with their van load of stuff the day before or something. So there's quite a bit of work for these volunteers that have set this up, because they have to put it all out and then be there on the right day and so on. Anyway, it's just a related thought, really, looking after people who might need it. So John, you had your hand up for a while.
Yeah, well, it's about the same point, really, because the gleaning continues. I didn't know about this thing that you're mentioning, Alison, but the gleaning definitely continues. And, friends of ours have relied on it in the past. Because otherwise they were going to starve, went and gleaned the oranges or the grapefruits or whatever other bits and pieces there were and the owners of the presuming it was the owners said, yeah, come and take some more, take it, because I can't use it because I've been through already. And please take it and it will get used well. So it continues in Israel. I'm not saying it continues everywhere, but it certainly does continue with a willing heart. Now, that wasn't actually what I was put my hand up for.
Okay.
I'm just thinking about the generational thing, because God's interested in generations too, and instituted a rather strange process of the brother of the dead brother, if that's the way to put it.
Yeah,
if there's a living one, and of course Ruth and Boaz that came in relation to that in the genealogy of the Lord Jesus. So I mean, it's a bit of a strange one, but nonetheless, God is keen on families. Let's put it like that, and not losing, because he talks about don't move the boundaries and things like that. So. Yeah. It's all about justice and doing the right thing for your neighbour, I guess.
And that law you mentioned, the Levirate law, I think it's called, about keeping the family line going, it's all to do with inheritance, that it stayed within the tribes, isn't it? And otherwise it would get lost and all go to another tribe. It was part of the regulation for it all, I think. So, and what I'm getting at is that, all that's in the Old Testament, but James pulls it out because it's still important. The other thing that fascinates me about those few verses at the end there is the use of the word religious or religion. And of course, we're always told not to be religious. Christianity isn't a religion. And I like to sort of counter that a little bit and say, well, what does James talk about here then if it's not religion? He's talking about how to do it properly, if you like. There is a religion that God, our Father, accepts. And he's not trying to define it all completely. He's just saying it certainly involves these. And the other thing he pulls in there about it is about keeping a tight rein on what you say. So if you consider yourself religious, he's saying it's not wrong to consider yourself religious, but it doesn't work. Your religion is worthless if you don't do it this way and you do it that way and so on. So when people say, oh, Jesus wasn't religious, I sort of take a deep breath and wonder whether to go there, but it's sort of, I thought he was one of the most religious Jews of his time, really. You look at what he did, he just seemed to know what true religion really was. But I know what people are getting at, because there's alternative religions and want to make sure we know we're different and so on. But
yep.
Alison.
Yeah, so I think Colossians 2 covers it all about false religion. We were doing this with the youth group at the weekend. So it just says that don't let anyone who delights in false humility and the worship of angels disqualify you. People going into great details about what they've seen, they're puffed up with idle notions by the. So it's all that puffed upness of religion. Yeah. So we were talking about this, and one of our 10-year-olds said, so I said, does anybody know about visions? And things? And she put her hand up and she says, yes, I had a vision. And she'd really hurt herself. And she saw this light, and then she saw this figure of person that she thought looked like an angel or like Jesus. But it's the first time she's ever told us. So I said, well, that's different, because you don't go around saying, I'm the person who's seen a vision. Difference, you know, where she brought it up in true humility.
Right.
So yes, she's very spiritual, she's very devoted to her faith, and she'll often come up with really deep things, but a religious person would be the one who says, now I'm the one who has the vision, so I'm
yeah, and can't wait to tell everybody, that sort of thing. Yeah. Thank you, yeah. Caroline, next, I think.
Yes, sorry, just going back to the orphan again. I just struck by...
Sorry, keep going.
Yeah, the father's heart for the widow and the orphan. You know, somewhere in the Old Testament, it says that God says he is the father of the fatherless.
Yeah.
And also in John, when Jesus is talking, he says, I won't leave you as orphans. Again, to me, it just completely shows how much the Lord cares.
Yeah.
Situation.
Yeah. It's Psalm 68, verse 5, that says he is a father to the fatherless,
yeah,
a defender of widows, is God in his holy dwelling. That's Psalm 68, verse 5.
I've just found the verse that I was thinking about.
Oh, excellent.
I'm so glad I found it. It's Luke 20, verse 47. Which says about the Pharisees, they devour widows' houses.
Yes.
Or in the New Living Translation, it says they shamelessly cheat widows out of their property.
Oh, right. That's interesting. So you're thinking literally it is houses, because I wondered if that was a sort of simile metaphor for something. But basically, they take full advantage of them because they steal everything.
Yeah,
that's right. It's always Luke. When you think you know something and you can't find it, always go to Luke first.
Oh, is that right?
No. That's where things are hidden. Little extra phases that we get in Luke. We know about the lengthy prayers, and we know about their flowing robes and marketplaces and seats and synagogues, but they say they devour widows' houses. Just say again what it read in yours about property.
Oh, so I've lost it now. Sorry.
It was something to do,
they shamelessly something widows of their property, but I forgot, I've lost it.
Okay, steal it or something, take it away.
Shamelessly.
Yeah. I mean, that is so the opposite of what the scripture says. I mean, it's not even just ignoring them or not treating them very well. That's taking really a bit of advantage, like, well, you don't even deserve a house now, do you? As though it's somehow their fault that they've become a widow. The tongue and the words bit comes in here from the very beginning, about being quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry, and so on. I rather like that. James is going to develop that quite a bit. I was going to share with you. Yes, there was a famous Greek philosopher of the 5th century BC called Zeno. And he said, we have two ears, but only one mouth, that we may hear more and speak less. So basically, just count your ears and count your mouth, and then you'll realise that you meant to do more listening, which is the same as what James is saying about being slow to do this and quick to do that and so on. And I thought I had another quote from, another philosopher from the 2nd century in Greece. How might a man rule best? without anger, speaking little and listening much. Speaking little and listening much. And there's a proverb, not surprisingly, when words are many, sin is not absent, but he who holds his tongue is wise. So basically, in anger, too many words come out, and then you tend to regret what you say when you have an outburst of anger. So listening is a great skill as well. Do we teach people properly how to listen? Do we teach our children how to listen? I mean, I go back to my days as a schoolmaster where you keep saying, listen, listen, and you know they're not going to bother for some reason. The typical thing used to happen in classes where I'm asked a question just seconds after that same question has been asked by someone else and I've answered it. And you think, well, where have you been for the past 30 seconds? Someone's just asked that and I've just answered it. Weren't you listening? You wonder what on earth they were doing. It was once said of a famous linguist that he could be silent in 7 languages all at the same time. Isn't that clever?
Yeah.
Some of us can't even keep quiet in one. I like that little quote there.
There's the same letters that spell listen also spell silent.
They do. They also spell tinsel. And this is another one. It's one of those collection of letters that you can play around with a lot. But certainly silent and listen go together very nicely. Yes. The other thing that comes up there, which I want to develop from another passage, is get rid of all moral filth and the evil that is so prevalent, and humbly accept the word planted in you, which can save you. But again, he doesn't lay it on, doesn't he, about get rid of all moral filth and the evil that is so prevalent. Have you got any other nice translations of that little bit? It's the first bit of verse 21. How else is that sometimes described?
New King James, therefore lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness.
Overflowing, yes. Anybody got any other?
Well, I don't know if you can hear me.
Oh, yes, I can.
It says, so rid yourselves of all vulgarity and obvious evil and receive meekly the word implanted in you so that you can save your lives.
Right. That's
complete Jewish.
Yeah. Anyone else got anything interesting on that verse too? I'll remind you what I read out earlier about this bit. Distance yourself completely from all that is morally repugnant and foul, just as you would throw away clothes so soiled and filthy they cannot be made clean again. If your behaviour and conduct is not to be corrupted, you must avoid contact with the overflowing abundance of evil that is all around. The overflowing abundance. Do you remember there's the verse where we're told... this is using that sort of idea in the other sort of way. That God gives exceedingly abundantly more than we can ask or think. Okay, I think I've got it. Yeah. And it's that idea of a super abundance. It's probably one of these Greek words that got hyper in it and all that sort of thing. But in the old AV, I think before the New King James sort of made it a bit more sort of accessible to us, I always remember, and I'm sure this must have been the AV, the oldest one, it talked about a superfluity of naughtiness, which is a wonderful phrase, but the superfluity of it, you know, sort of overflowingness, excess of evil or surplus of sin or mass of malice and so on. But anyway, that's an old way of doing it.
But the ESV has rampant wickedness.
Rampant, right. Which version?
My first practice agreement, there was a phrase in it about partner, they could remove a partner for being flagrantly immoral.
Flagrantly. Not flagrantly, but flagrantly.
Not flagrantly, yes. Or in secret.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could be a little bit immoral, you know.
Well, yes. Really, you knew what it meant, and we all had a good laugh about it, but
yeah,
it changed.
Well, I used to use the phrase, again, going back to school days, of willful disobedience. But then I thought, what kind of disobedience isn't willful? It's always willful, isn't it? But it just seemed to make it, well, you've been willfully disobedient, my boy, sort of thing. But just to make it clear. But, so, yes.
Can I ask, what version was that that said rampant wickedness?
The ESV, English Standard Version.
I think it's one of those little passages, little Greek bits that, you know, it does allow for a lot of interesting English phrases and words that you can pull in and all that. I know we've had a bit of a laugh about the use of the language. Let's not forget the main point of it. It is get rid of it. Get rid of it. It's almost like it can't exist alongside the word that's implanted in you. One is going to dominate or the other. And that leads me now to the other passage, sort of moving away from the chapter one, to the similar bit in chapter four and verse four. Well, it is verse four, really. Both bits of verse four. And this is one of the reasons I'm doing James with you, is because we're looking at this in our church meetings. And this coming Sunday, that's a verse that I've chosen to say something on. So you're helping me now with my sort of preparation a little bit, really. But I've been thinking about this verse. Verse 4, it's in two bits. You adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world is hatred towards God? And then anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. Basically sort of doubling it up a little bit. But I'm interested in your comments on what you think is coming up there. I mean, let's start at the beginning, which is, why do you think he starts off, you adulterous people? I mean, is that just James laying it on again pretty thick and fast? Or is there, to be honest, I'm going to leave that bit to one side, although it's part of the text. It's not the main bit I want to speak on, but it does have a point to it, I think.
Isn't it? Marriage of the Lamb, the marriage of the church to Jesus.
Yeah, I think that is where you do bring it out.
It's constant, isn't it? It's kind of, or anything that is not being totally bound to Yeshua.
Yeah, and it does go back into the Old Testament of Israel being like a harlot or chasing after other gods. And also Paul's point about, says, don't you know you are betrothed to Christ? And we're very keen on the idea of, oh, one day we're going to be married and, you know, we're the bride of Christ and we're going to be wonderful in heaven. But actually we are betrothed now.
Yeah.
As you know, this long betrothal period when they got ready for the marriage, both bride and groom. And anything at this point that doesn't fit in with that preparation for life together is equivalent of, well, adultery. So... So when he says friendship with the world is hatred towards God, one of the things I want to explain is what friendship with the world actually looks like. So firstly, do we understand what is meant by the word world in this sort of context? What are we getting at with, where do we use that? John?
Yeah, before you go on with what the... Looking for an answer to what you just asked, I'm thinking of the way you translated that other verse, talking about this overwhelming, avoid contact with the overflowing abundance of evil. This made me think of floods where the sewage comes up.
Yeah.
And you can't go out your door without, you can't do anything without standing in all that sewage. And that's pretty much certainly turning on a television or looking at hardly anything is like standing in a sewer. And I think that's where this friendship with the world, it's walking out in a street that's flooded with sewage.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting.
Beautiful thought, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it is. But why not? Because James likes to give us those very vivid pictures to really make us think, oh, gosh, it's really like that, is it? So the world, so we've got two people coming in. We'll have Alice and then Pat.
So I'm just asking Rosewell, anybody really. So can you walk in that sewage if you're clothed in the armour of God? So if you were going to walk through a sewer, you would put on special clothing. If you go to pick up somebody with Ebola virus, you put on special clothing. So if you're clothed with the armour of God, can you then go out and walk through the sewer and be in contact?
Yes, I was thinking, before I, you know, put my hand up and wanted to say something, I was thinking about holy wellies, you know, from the Ephesians, where you should put on the armour of God. I mean, how high can your sandals go, and can they be holy wellies?
Go on, Jackie.
Isn't that it? That to me just brings in that verse that we are in the world but not of the world. That is the whole point of you know, being able to walk through the sewage if we are prepared for that and properly clothed, as it were.
Yeah, but I think the point is, if we have to go that way, if some reason for it, we're called into it, then there is the protection, there is the armor that's there anyway. But you shouldn't choose to do that, or choose to do it, because actually what we're really getting at is that people would be friendly with the world because that's what they want to do. That's the way they're going to live, rather than just, I'm caught in it, caught up in it. Because yes, we are in the world in one sense, but not of it, which is coming back to my question about how do we understand this word world. I go to Pat next because she was waiting. You're muted though. You're still muted, Pat. Do you realise that?
Sorry, I'm not at home, by the way, but I think of the world as the world's systems, which are in opposition to God's systems.
Yeah, thanks. I'll come back to that, but let's take up Caroline, then Betty.
It just makes me think of Psalm 1, where it says, how blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, or sit in the seat of scoffers. And that is just, you know, getting involved with, you know, joining in with the world's thinking and behaviours.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Betty?
Yes, I was just thinking that it's like two kingdoms, isn't it? There's the kingdom that belongs to God and the kingdom that belongs to the other one.
Yeah. So the Greek word, which is cosmos, that's used, obviously means the physical world, the physical universe, you know, the cosmos. Nothing wrong with that. I know it's fallen, but that in itself isn't the main problem. And it can also mean, of course, everybody in the world, as in God so loved the world. So it can be the world population. Again, that's not the point of it. But as you said, it's this system, this anti-God setup, obviously because of the fall and so on, where it's more than just ungodly, it's totally godless, because it doesn't have God in its thinking at all, and it feeds on the pride of man and fleshly ways, carnal thinking and so on. And it is a spiritual force. It is an anti-kingdom, if you like, from that point of view. And it's become institutionalized, which is why that at some point you could say, well, it's now so prevalent that how can you do anything in the world without at least being some way contaminated by it, or you've got to protect yourself from it, because it's become the norm, and it's what calls good evil and evil good. It's what distorts all the usual things that we know of as being godly, and it's created a totally different what you might call set of ideas, values, morals and so on, that is then integrated into the mainstream. So that's bound to be what comes out of your television and other things and books and so on today, because that's the dominant spiritual force behind it. We've got Caroline and then Malcolm. You're muted, Caroline. Oh, that was an old hand, was it?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, Malcolm.
Yeah, it's like living together nowadays.
Hmm.
That seems to be the normal way.
Yeah. Because that's what happens. These things then become the norm eventually, which is why they're so difficult to distance yourself from. I mean, I heard from someone in one of our house groups at church, I think her grandson has just gone to university, and he's actually shocked because, he's brought up as a Christian, and he's just shocked at what they're going to get up to, all these so-called friends, the people he wants to be friends with, but he can't join in with them because they seem to be only there in order to do drink, drugs and sex. And that's become almost what 90% of university life is meant to be about. So he's got to fight that one somehow. He's got to come through strong in all that. Hopefully the Christian Union there is strong, and hopefully his family can help him. Otherwise, that can lead people astray. John?
Yeah, and the worrying thing is when some of the so-called churches kowtow to worldly things.
Yeah.
So that's a real worry at the moment. Well, yeah. It's probably been a real worry for many years, actually. You mentioned, I think it was last time, you had the phrase fake wisdom, the devil's fake wisdom.
Yeah.
And there's a whole web of wrong thinking when you compare it with God's thinking and what God's wants, which we find in his word. So anything that doesn't match up with
that. Yeah. To your doctor. Now, if the test is negative... Sorry, let's get rid of that. Go on, keep going, John.
Whatever doesn't match up with God's word is effectively a no-no. some folk doesn't seem to have noticed, sadly. And Justin Welby has launched himself in oodles of times, it seems, on some of these things. But there we go. Hey ho. It's kowtowing to the fashionable. Which is then the world, isn't it?
It is. And that's James's point about the two kinds of wisdom, the wisdom from above, but there is the other wisdom that's earthly, unspiritual, and the devil. And my translation has wisdom in sort of quotes, because that's not the real wisdom. But there is this alternative. Like, of course, everything that the devil does is a counterfeit of something like that. Malcolm, then Betty.
Well, what I was going to say was, John mentioned the church. I mean, we now have homosexual bishops and many homosexual vicars, or, whatever they're called in their denomination.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also thought that Canterbury stuffed his fist in and said that we must not move the embassy to Jerusalem.
Right, I haven't heard that, I must admit. So.
Yeah. Oh, well, when it first came up in the news about moving the embassy,
okay,
he turned around and said, no, you must not move to Jerusalem.
Right. Doesn't surprise me, though. Okay. Betty?
Yes, I was just thinking about your friend's son that's just gone to university, and that... I mean, that's an awful dilemma, but it's a dilemma that we've all got in greater or smaller, that you want to be friends with people, you want to get on with people, we need to live in this world, and it's particularly difficult for a young person.
Because you might have been very sheltered. Might have been very sheltered up to that point, and so he's suddenly got the shock of it all, and, I'm sure he'll be okay, but he's got to learn something there that he didn't realise.
But it's such a temptation for all of us, because we don't want to go against people and sort of holier than now sort of attitude. But
yeah.
You just can't take it on board.
Yeah, good point. I mean, I've had this a little bit in my day, because even when I become beyond a school age, a teacher, I wouldn't go to the pub with my friend, with people that I might otherwise want to be friendly with. Looking back, I'm wondering whether I overdid it a little bit, because there's no great harm in just going and having one drink and so on. But I decided I wanted to stand up, and I think some of them, you know, took it a bit the wrong way. So making some of these decisions is a bit tricky sometimes. Elizabeth.
Yeah, I do think we need to pray for especially the young people, because I'm not even sure that there's some colleges, you know, I don't even have a student union, you know. So we need to pray for that they'll have enough Christians around them to just maybe form informal groups, you know, where they can meet. But I think that James is strong on things, but I think it's so relevant for today. Mm. You know, the level of evil that we're coming against today, and is going to just, well, we know where it's heading, don't we? We know it's going to get worse. So it's so good to be reading and studying these things and applying it more and thinking about it more, so that we can actually impact our lives personally on a level, so we're even stronger in our faith.
Yeah,
I think we'll need to be.
Indeed. I mean, the only alternative is if there's a revival, then you might see some kind of reversal of some of these things. But so another way to understand this aspect of the world, what it means, is if you remember that Jesus refers to the devil as the prince or ruler of this world. And Jesus also said, my kingdom is not of this world, which doesn't mean he doesn't want the kingdom of heaven on earth, but it just doesn't match up with this other world. And when Jesus does refer to the devil as the prince or ruler, the Greek word there is archon, which is used in the Roman world for the highest ranking Roman official in a city or region, the most powerful and influential person in that locality. What Jesus is doing is taking that known illustration of this powerful, influential guy in that city or region and saying, when it comes to the devil, he's got it everywhere. It's all over the place. His power and influence stretches beyond one place into everywhere. So all the aspects of life have been infiltrated, if you like, by his influence. And not just now, but this has been happening over the whole of human history, and therefore it's even more embedded, because although it's this sort of new ways now in which this can happen, so we say through technology or television or whatever, it's just the latest development of something that's been there in human thinking and human activity all time. This is what John writes in 1 John chapter 2. Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For everything in the world, the cravings of the sinful man, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away, but the man who does the will of God lives forever. That's 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 and 17. I don't know how much you look at those small little letters of John. I tend to feel they get bypassed quite a bit. We go for all the other letters and we think of the Gospels and so on. But there's three little letters by John. And the first letter is not a little one, really. And he does define there the world, the cravings of the sinful man, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does, saying this all comes from the world, not the Father. And there's this conflict of love. And that's coming back to the idea in James of friendship with the world and adulterous people. It's eventually, what do you really love? So friendship with the world is about having a proper relation. Well, it's about having a relationship in such a way that it's like you can't serve two masters. You can't love both God and money, taking money to be the, you know, that root of all evil, where materialism and so on, all to do with selfishness and so on. It creates a love for it. So if you start to sort of get friendly with the world, it develops into a more intimate and powerful relationship till eventually you're an adulterous person from that point of view. So you have to, well, cut it out completely and so on. And it's all about being in the right covenant. If you remember the story of Elijah and the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, yeah, you will remember that big dramatic scene in 1 Kings 18, I think it is, where he calls Israel together and he says, basically, you've got to make up your mind here. He says, why do you waver between two opinions? If Yahweh is God, follow him. If Baal is God, follow him. Baal represented the other deity, if you like, the alternative worldly system that everybody else was worshipping and involved with. And he gave them that very stark picture, really. And when he says, how do you waver between two opinions, why are you doing that? Yeah, the illustration is almost, why are you limping along between two? It's as though you've got one foot on the road, one on the pavement or something, two different levels, and you're trying to walk like this. And what happens? You're unstable. You might even fall over. You just eventually can't do it. You can't walk in two directions at the same time or two paths at the same time. So it's a very powerful image of it. And of course, well, in the end, Elijah wins, but he has to bring them to this point of understanding that their desire to have friendship with Baal, basically, and also to worship God, just doesn't work. And as a result of that, of course, they'd had 3 years of drought, a very severe dose of climate change due to sin and rebellion, by the way. and the second part of this verse in James, it's anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world. So in the end, it's the choices that you make, your decision. It might be that you just sort of drift along a little bit, but ultimately, you know, you make a choice and you become an enemy of God. And what I got out of that, and you can check me up and tell me if I haven't quite sorted this out yet, but I don't think, certainly not here, and I don't think anywhere in the scripture, it talks about God becoming our enemy. We become an enemy of God, but it's a one-way thing. Even if we are going astray in the world, God doesn't become our enemy. It's just that we become his enemy. Can you see the difference? Mm. And I honestly don't think there's anywhere in scripture that says anywhere. I mean, God might punish, you might discipline and so on. But the way I see it is that if we turn our back on God, he never turns his back on us. He's still looking in that direction. You see what I'm trying to say here? So it's like the prodigal son going away, but the father's still there waiting, all that sort of thing. I think the whole of scripture is saying, if you become an enemy of God, that doesn't make God your enemy. And while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. While we were enemies of God, he reconciled us through the cross. That's the whole thing. Because we've all been enemies of God. That's how we start in life, don't we? Until we are converted and become a friend of God. And so you've always got a chance to come back into friendship with God. But you can't be a friend with someone if you're not facing them. You've got to really be face to face, haven't you? And you've got to be walking together and so on. You can't do it at a distance. Betty, you've got something to add here?
Yeah, it's just in this translation I've got here, it's stronger than becoming an enemy of God. It says you make yourself an enemy of God.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. I think I've seen that in one thing there. your choice makes you an enemy of God. And actually, if you think about it, that's a horrible thing to happen to a Christian. If you've really got to warn someone, and they're going astray, you've become an enemy of God. Again, you always stress that God hasn't become your enemy, so you can still get back together if you like. But yeah, it is a choice that leads to, well, something as strong as anything. And I don't think there's any other way of deciding on that word. It is an enemy. It's severe as that. So the enmity is all on our side. It's never on God's side. Sorry, go on. Elizabeth, is it?
It talks about God being faithful. He can't not be faithful.
Yeah.
But we can be faithful. We can be not faithful, you know.
Yeah.
It's his character to be loving and faithful.
Yeah, that's
very well put. We need to get really hold of who he is to help us, you know, in our faith. Yeah.
Because that's what's meant to sort of keep us in this covenant relationship, that actually once we realise that's entirely what he's like, then that should create even more sort of worship and admiration and adoration. Wow, you know, that's what he's like. I want to be with this God, if you like. John or Rose?
Yeah, you actually said the word I was going to say, covenant relation.
Yeah.
And then thinking about the Jewish people and this very sad thing about replacement theology or even dual covenantism, never mind the rampant anti-Semitism that is expounded or followed through by so many who might claim themselves to be Christians, and certainly has done in the past. It's seriously sad, and reveals a lack of understanding of God's covenant nature. So it's anyway.
And therefore it creates a different perception of Christianity as, well, that can't be a covenant in the same way. Then we miss out on what the truth of it really is. There's another statement, it's in Mark's Gospel, which has always struck me from very early days. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? That's a very powerful question. It's very serious, isn't it? That what good is it for a man to gain everything in the world, be completely in the world, and yet you end up forfeiting your own soul? And the last point, I suppose, going back to what Jesus said when he was here on earth, he said, now is the time for judgment on this world. So the thing to get across is that this world is going to be judged. So the more involved you are in it, the closer you are to it, the more friendly you are, the more you're setting yourself up ultimately for judgment. And I know that Jesus was referring particularly there, I suppose, to the fact that the devil was about to be judged. And of course, the cross was that big moment that he might be referring to. Now has come judgment. The prince of this world will be judged and therefore driven out and so on. And of course, until he finally is completely judged and driven out, he's still doing great damage to things. But what happens to the world at the very end? It's judged. And that judgment is very severe. So we need to be aware that part of this being an enemy of God is actually almost inviting God to judge us. He might just discipline us. He might do something like that. But if you stay in the world, you've got nowhere to go because you're going to be judged in the end. Betty?
Isn't that what's happening in this country now, Paul?
Say again, sorry?
Isn't that what's happening in this country now?
About judgment and so on. Yeah. I mean, I've had the thought that with what we're seeing at this precise moment, these last few days, is actually a culmination of what's been happening within government and parliament over quite a period of time. Because you think back to things like, was it cash for votes, that sort of thing? All the other scandals. I don't mean the recent Partygate stuff, but you know, it's almost like one thing has led to another, the bullying, the harassment, the sexual allegations. You know, for quite some time, there seems to have been things going on within that institution, which clearly are not what you want from your place of government and authority and what you want to respect. And I think God is bringing it out into the light. And as a result, all sorts of things are happening that we see the headline stuff. We find about resignations and things like that. But there's something now rotten at the heart of our government system. And that's not a party political point. It could easily happen, you know, again with another group of people. I mean, they're talking about Boris coming back, aren't they? It's probably an alternative now to the others. I mean, wouldn't that just be ironic? I mean, you couldn't believe it, really, could you? You couldn't, if you wrote this up and sent it in for a drama for the BBC. I mean, you'd think, well, no, they might think it's okay to do, but it's really weird. Betty, you want to add something?
Yeah, I was just adding on to that. It's almost as though this restraining hand of Queen Elizabeth and her Christian faith is now gone. And
well,
it's a different atmosphere over this country.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that put, and I must admit, I'm sort of happy with the idea, but I don't fully understand how that works, except, if you like, the grace of God has been over us because of her and her faith. But there's a bit more shaking to come. I mean, don't forget the monarchy as a whole has been part of what's been shaken. We rejoiced in the Queen and her faith and so on, but if you read, as I have read some other books about what's been going on in the royal family, again, these things come out. They've been judged, really, and found wanting in many cases. Again, not the Queen, but so that institution is being shaken, government's being shaken, the church is being shaken, the economy's been, I mean, everything. There we go. Mary?
I liked the analogy of how God still faces us, but we turn our back. But I had somebody explain something to me which was lovely, that we're under the covering of God, you know.
Yeah.
we step out and we've lost that covering. It's like the shadow of the wings, as it were. When we get too far out, we've lost that covering. And I think that's what's happened in Great Britain. We've turned our back. We've stepped out of the covering that we should be under, with all the terrible laws and things that were...
Yes.
It's shocking, really.
It's almost like God doesn't have to over-punish us because we bring it down upon ourselves by walking away. Because either, as you rightly say, word covering is a good one, you're either close to God and therefore receiving all that he has for us, or we're not, and therefore, well, you're easy prey. You can't be neutral. You're either part of his kingdom or the other kingdom.
There are only two kingdoms.
Yeah.
And you're either in it, you're either in one kingdom or you're going against that kingdom.
Indeed, And just to pick up, the Elijah thing, we read that sort of thing and think, oh, that was in the past and they had their problems with Baal and so on. But actually with all these false gods, the spiritual forces behind them are still around. We may not call them that anymore, but and I think I've heard someone put it like this, I haven't read any more about this, but all those old gods like Baal, Molech, Ishtar and so on, it's almost like they've come to the fore again, which God will allow to happen so he can judge things, so we expect that. But I've always said, the devil doesn't have any new tricks. He just keeps, recycling the old ones because they work so well. So why does he need to invent new things? And we're told to be aware of the devil's schemes or methods because we can be aware of them. He's not that original. Powerful, but we should know what this sort of thing is going to be like. So you can, that passage about standing against them is then go on to take on the armor of God. So, we've got that protection. Malcolm.
Most popular God today is me.
Yeah, indeed. Not you personally, Malcolm, we understand that. Yes. We understand what you're saying,
And also it says submit to yourselves to God and the devil will flee from you.
Yeah.
So I'd like to dwell more on that one because that's quite a powerful promise, isn't it?
Well, it is, isn't it? That is the way back, isn't it? Humbly submitting. Go back to God and ask him to look after you again. And that does defeat the devil, doesn't it? I mean, he won't want to get too close to God. So the closer you are to God, the more he will distance himself. Simple as that, really. Well, simple and difficult at the same time. Anybody else want the final word? Otherwise, I'm going to stop the recording.
But I don't want it to be the final word, but just picking up on what Mary said about the covering, I think that's a lovely analogy. You think of the canopy over the bride and groom.
And the the imagery that Jesus has of the mother hen covering her chicks with her wings and so on.
Isn't it like the eagle that's flying and the little one can't get too far away, because if he does, mother can't protect in a way.
Yeah, sure, all that sort of thing. Yeah.
Also his garment as well, because we consider it the wings of his garment.
Yeah.
And they've got the word in there too.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd bring yourself under the word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the idea of the tallit, the prayer shawl that you cover yourself in to, it's almost the equivalent of go into your closet, if you like. It's a funny way of translating it. I'm sure it sort of just means get private with God in some way. And that's, of course, the use of their prayer shawl is to cover themselves. I'm going to stop the recording then. Now. I think I'm just about to do this. Are you sure I want to stop?